سليمي.
الحمد لله، والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. Distinguished guests, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We are welcome to this important webinar where we will be discussing this very important issue, the rape and the rapist in Islamic jurisprudence. We just like to apologize. Okay, alhamdulillah, I think Dr. Bashir has just joined us. So inshallah, the discussion, the presentation will last for an hour or so, while 30 to 40 minutes, inshallah, will be for Q&A and comments from our audience, bi-ibnillah. Assalamu alaikum. Sorry for that interruption. So our panelists, as I said, we have five distinguished scholars with us. They are all from different backgrounds, but each and every one of them is wearing more than a cap, inshallah, as you will get to know them better. We have Dr. Bashir Ali Umar with us as one of the panelists, and also is going to be our first presenter. You're welcome, Dr. Bashir. And also we have the barrister Nuruddin Asunoge, also is going to join us. We have Dr. Amina Abubakar, the First Lady of Niger State here. You're welcome, Ma. Then we have Professor Ahmad Bello Dogarawa, is also one of the panelists. Without taking much of our time, I'm going to say little about Dr. Bashir Umar, but just to let the participants or our audience know that a number of issues will be addressed during the various presentations. We are going to be looking at definition of rape, or modern definition of rape, to really understand, it entails, the meaning of that. And also we want to know how serious is rape in Islamic law and its teachings, and also a topic like punishment for rape in Nigerian legal punishments, and in Islamic law. And also one of the issues that will be looked at or discussed is ways of improving reporting and prosecution of rape, also care of rape victims, stigmatization and trauma, also among the topics, the challenge of proving rape and or the evidences for rape. Then also the challenge of pregnancy from rape and the ruling of abortion in Islamic law. We have a lot of scholars, as I said, that will be addressing this issue. Then also statutory rape and the age of consent. Nigeria, particularly so far. Inshallah, I will want to request the presenters that inshallah they have a limited time, wisdom, they will be able to do justice to the topics given. Whatever could not be touched very well or covered, I believe during comments or question and answer, we still refer back to them. Let me start with Dr. Bashir Ali Umar and say something about his profile, just for us to know who he is. Dr. Bashir Umar was born in Kano. He started his university education in Ahmadu Bello University in electrical engineering before going to Islamic University in Medina, where he later did his BA, MA, and PhD in Islamic studies. Specialization is sciences of the Hadith. Also, he studied Maliki Fiqh and Usul under traditional scholars in Nigeria and in Medina. He served in different capacity and is still serving, of course, in Nigeria and abroad. He was a strategy of the Central Bank of Nigeria. He was also a special advisor to the CBN governor on non-interest banking from 2010 to 2014, during which the guidelines for the regulation and supervision of non-interest financial institutions in Nigeria were issued, and the first non-interest banks were licensed, and CBN liquidity management instruments were introduced in the in Nigeria. I think Dr. Bashir did a lot. I think inshallah you get to know that we display his profile very soon. He's involved in all this issue of finance and many other in Nigeria and abroad, in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. He's a member of Sharia Committee of the International Islamic Liquidity Management Corporation. Over there, and also is also a member of Council of Scholars of International Sharia Research Academy, ISRA, in Bank Negara, that is Central Bank Malaysia. Currently is with BUK, the Bayero, Bayero University, Kano, and is heading Center of Islamic Civilization and Interfaith Dialogue, and well known. If you go to Kano, you are looking for Al-Furqan Mosque, and they will tell you Dr. Bashir is the chief imam of the mosque and also the director of the center. Dr. Bashir, you are highly welcome. You have 15 minutes for your presentation, sir. Jazakumullahu khairan.
Thank you very much, Brother Ismail. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen. Sayyidina wa nabiyyina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man sara ala nahjihi wa iktafa atharahu ila yawmiddin. Amma ba'd. My dear brothers and sisters, in this forum, in this webinar, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It is quite an honor to be with you to discuss this topic, to speak orders on the psychological and biological well-being of a wide number of members of our society, the women folk, and not only the women folk as well as the men. It strikes at the very fabric of our existence as healthy community, as one of the absolute necessities, the protection of which is regarded as an as a darura, as an absolute necessity, and the maslaha, the benefit of it, the benefit of protecting it is regarded as absolutely necessary, and the harm of eradicating, the harm of lack of protection of that honor is also regarded as a serious harm that has to be eradicated at the level of necessity, because the tartib of the maqasid of Sharia, the fundamental intents of the Sharia, the protection of the religion, the protection of life, the protection of intellect, the protection of honor comes at the fourth level, even higher than the protection of wealth. So the question of rape in Islamic jurisprudence, it is very, very important. And the first, regarding the definition, the fuqaha, in their definition of rape, they define it as the illicit, the illegitimate sexual intercourse of a man with a woman, either vaginal or anal, without free will and consent of the victim, which is the woman. It has restricted the definition of rape as between a man and a woman, and the definition of rape between a man and a man, or between a woman and a man, or where the woman is the perpetrator and the man is the victim, the definition is silent on it. Even though the definition of sexual violation of a man by another man is regarded as sodomy, and it is also treated as illicit intercourse together with coercion. The fuqaha, they address this under the al-ghasb wal-i'tida, which is forcible seizure and transgression on rights. They call it, either they call it al-iqtisab, as Ibn Asim in his ode on fiqh al-mu'amalat in the madhab of Imam Malik, Tuhfatul Hukam, he mentioned it as a chapter under the collection of chapters on al-qasbu wa ta'addi wa al-i'tida, that is forcible seizure and transgression. So as well, tradition earlier than that, the fuqaha, they address it under forcible intercourse. Like Imam Malik in the Muwatta, he talked about this under Kitab al-Aqdiya, the book of the judgments, which is talking about the activities or the rules and judgments of juries and judges in Islam, and he talked about it on al-qada fi al-mustakrahati min al-nisa, that is the judgment regarding the one that was compelled or that was coerced among women. The coercion, it means coercion to have sexual intercourse. Now this is so it is regarded as transgression and coercion, and it is transgression and coercion is not limited to what is between a man and a woman, it can also take the judgment of any other transgression between a woman and a woman, or a man and a man, or a woman over a man, because transgression is transgression, whoever the perpetrator is and whoever the victim is. But why rape is regarded as limited to between a man and a woman is because the majority of the fuqaha, they regard rape as an offshoot of zina, which is illicit sexual intercourse. They regard it as an offset of zina, with the only difference being the question of lack of free will and consent. And they are not limiting it to forcible coercion, but even like having sexual intercourse with a sleeping woman or an insane woman is also given this judgment according to the juries. The challenge regarding rape is the question of establishing it. The question of establishing the question of establishing, but before then, what is its position? How serious could it be regarded under the Islamic teachings? As we saw, rape is an act of zina, so it falls under the major sins, that have been described as kaba'ir, which Allah has tabaraka wa ta'ala mentioned in the Quran, in Surah Al-Isra, وَلَا تَقْرَبُ الزِّنَا إِنَّهُ كَانَ فَاحِشَةً وَسَاءَ سَبِيلًا. Do not come near fornication or adultery. It's an act of abomination and is an evil path. So it is regarded as a major sin, which means that the perpetrator is not regarded, he loses the quality of uprightness, he is not adil, and he is not forgiven until he makes tawbah, and it is one of the acts for which there are capital punishment of hudud. The punishments under the Sharia are categorized into al-qisas, which is equitable reprisal, or al-hudud, which are the specified punishments by Allah and His Messenger, or ta'zir, which are the punishments that are the subject of the independent judgment of the ruler or the judge. So zina is regarded as a punishment that is the subject of had. And in addition, rape adds another dimension, which is the dimension of forcible coercion, which is the dimension of a transgression on the honor of a woman. So it is it has these two aspects of serious serious connotations under the Sharia. The punishment for it, according to the juries, is the punishment of zina. Is the punishment of zina, which is for the person that has been previously married, al-muhsan, which is stoning till death, and for the one who has not been married before, is 100 lashes and banishment for 1 year. In addition, it could be the circumstances surrounding it could make the qadi prescribe a judgment that could be lesser than the had, or that could be other than the had, because there are clear limitations on how to establish zina under the Sharia. But with regards to rape, establishing it, even though it is a challenge, but the fuqaha the Maliki fuqaha, they have made a lot of leeway in opening the restrictions that are there in establishing zina. As we know, zina is established either by confession or by the testimony of four male witnesses to the actual act of sexual intercourse, or by a pregnancy appearing with a woman who is not known to have been married, and who is not known to be married or to have been married within a period that is covered by the maximum period for which pregnancy is permissible, which is 4 years. But in case of rape, because of its special and rare circumstance, the fuqaha of Maliki fiqh, they add another source of evidence for establishing rape, which is that if there is a testimony, if there are witnesses that will witness that the accused has had an opportunity to be in solitary confinement with the victim, as he said in Antofa, that rape is established walau bi bayyina bi annahu khala biha, that if there is witnesses that will establish that he had been in solitary confinement with the victim, which and for that you need the testimony of only two people, in such a case rape will be established. But in a case where that even that is lacking, the Maliki fuqaha, especially Ibn Rushd, he has given elaborate circumstances of establishing it, which is that if the accused, he categorized the accused into three: someone who is known for his uprightness in religion, and someone whose character is unknown, and someone whose character is known to be a fasiq, that is a transgressor against the limits of Allah. And for each of these categories, whether the victim, she makes the accusation immediately after the act, while having circumstantial evidence that are showing that she is indeed a victim of the act, or she makes her claim several years or several days or months after the incident has occurred. Now, in each of these six, so you'll have a situation of six cases where the accused is upright and the woman is making the claim immediately after the act, while having some circumstantial evidence that shows her to be a victim, like coming out, like she was shouting and asking and screaming for help, or she came out, she has been disfigured, there is blood in her private parts, and maybe also evidence of the semen of the perpetrator. Or she makes the claim several years later, as we are seeing now in newspapers. Somebody who is already in her 40s, she will claim that when she was in her 20s, she was sexually assaulted by somebody. And the same with all the other cases. So in each case, the fuqaha, they have given what is the ruling regarding the establishing the case of rape. In addition, there is another area which the fuqaha have mentioned, which is the area of the civil action. That is when...
So you have just 2 minutes more, sir.
Okay. When rape is established, the woman is entitled to compensation, which is sadaqul mithl. Now, regarding punishment, I want to go back to it a bit. There are some scholars, especially now in modern times, that are strongly agitating that rape should be regarded as an act of hiraba, which is an act of carrying up arms against the Muslims in the society. And several evidences are being cited. And the And also, it is claimed to be the opinion of Ibn al-Arabi in his tafsir. Honestly, it is not the opinion of Ibn al-Arabi per se, because the surah, the form that Ibn al-Arabi said is when there is kidnap, it is a case of kidnap plus rape. So the kidnapping definitely is an act of hiraba. And also the athar that have been mentioned, the athar from Umar, they involve kidnapping. So the juries that treat rape as an act of, and that punish rape as an act of hiraba, they are doing it because of the element of kidnap that was involved in it. So this has to be identified, even though now, as I said, there is growing calls for it. The Ministry of Justice of Saudi Arabia made a call for this in Tunis. They are also making this, as well as the fatwa of the fatwa of some muftis in Egypt. They are also calling for rape to be given, to be regarded as an act of hiraba. And definitely, when you take hiraba to have to give it a very wide meaning, you will include things that are not clearly mentioned by Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, and they may not be the intent of the Sharia to include them. Since we have a punishment that has been established, the issue is to establish it, and the punishment of the Sharia is permissible. And when you are unable to execute the had, there is always the majal, there is always the chance to do ta'zir, in which there is a lot of leeway. Because ta'zir, especially in Maliki fiqh, can lead to the extent of having a capital punishment for the perpetrator of a crime. Because there are many instances whereby we have ta'zir being done with a capital punishment and sending the perpetrator, the accused, to the gallows. Wallahu ta'ala a'la.
Jazakumullah khairan. Thank you very much for the wonderful presentation. I know there are more things the doctor wanted to say, but because of time limitation, he has touched on a number of issues, which I'm not going to repeat because of time constraint, but I believe most of us are taking notes and putting some points down. He touched on the definition according to the jurists, also touched on the punishment and all the arguments surrounding that, and also touched on the evidences, how to establish it, among other things. Let me request our audience, because of our time, we appreciate if you can keep sending some of the questions you are having so that we can go through them, and just so to avoid spending much time on questions after all the presentations, inshallah. We will be having Barrister Asonoge as our next presenter, who is going to also be touching on some of the issues that Doctor has discussed and some others. Barrister Asonoge Nuruddin works with the University of Benin. Is the chairman Nigeria Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs, Edo States, also a member of the Expanded Working Committee of the Supreme Islamic Body in Nigeria, is the Deputy National President, DCCN, Adawa Coordinating Council of Nigeria, also a former National Amir of Muslim Student Society of Nigeria. He's a human and a Muslim rights activist, and a proactive and pragmatic da'iya, married with children, of course. I think most of us in MSS youth, they all know Asonoge very well. And inshallah, we'd like to have you. Inshallah, falyatafaddal. I remember when I was discussing with somebody that Barrister Asonoge is going to join us, he said to me, hope he's going to simplify in his presentation the English. I said, well, this is going to be the first time I'm listening to him. You are welcome, sir. Okay. I learned there is a network issue. It's heavily raining in their place over there now, and it's affecting the network. In case there is serious problem and we can't hear him, we may have to move to the third panelist, Barrister Sunuge. So we can hear. Okay, I learned there is a challenge. Can I request that we have Professor Hajara Umar Suleiman for her presentation? Because I learned there is a challenge problem over there with Asunuge. If Professor Hajara Umar could just carry on with her presentation. Professor Hajara Umar Suleiman, consultant of obstetrics and gynecologist at the Ahmadu Bello Teaching Hospital Zaria. She is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Ahmadu Bello University, as Samaru Zaria, a lecturer of 500 level medical students, and also postgraduate students in the same university. She is the National Amira of Islamic Medical Association of Nigeria. She's been a doctor for a donkey of years, 22 years. She's been a gynecologist for the past 13 years. Alhamdulillah, I've listened to Professor Hajara, I think, on this issue, I think a few days or a week ago. And not only doctor, but also she's also wearing another cap. Inshallah, I believe our presentation will reflect that. Thank you very much, Ma. You have 10 minutes only for your presentation.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Wa sallallahu ala man la nabi ba'd. Inshallah, I'll just go straight to the topic since one of our sheikhs have already spoken. And as regarding how serious rape it is in Islamic law and its teaching, and I think from the way things have gone presently in Nigeria and the epidemic proportion that the rape has taken, I think it goes beyond regarding it as the same thing as zina. Because in zina, the partners are consenting, whereas in rape, it is actually a transgression against another human being. And I tend to buy the opinion that the person that is a rapist is actually a muharib, that is, it should be regarded as ikhtiraba. And that is a person who wages war against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his Rasul, and is also a person that causes harm within the society. And based on Islamic law, his punishment should either be that he should be killed, he should be crucified, his leg and hand on opposite sides should be cut, and then he should be exiled. That is what is expected to be the correct punishment for somebody that transgresses against another human being. Under Imam Malik and Abu Hanifa, they actually said that the rapist should pay the dowry. In terms of the challenge of proving evidence for somebody that has been raped, the best results are actually obtained when the person comes immediately after the incidents, and the person does not have a bath, has not urinated, and has not changed her clothes. And there are several samples that will be taken from these victims that can be used as an evidence. And in societies where they have a DNA database, you can actually do the typing of the DNA of the semen to that of the culprit, and you can actually identify that person specifically. In Nigeria, most of the time we use circumstantial evidence, just as mentioned by my Sheikh Malam Bashir, Dr. Bashir, and also a physical examination by the doctor, as well as these investigation results that is written together in the form of a medical report, can actually be used in a court of law to prove that somebody has actually been raped. In terms of the challenge of pregnancy from the rape and ruling of abortion in Islamic law, first, during the time that a rape victim comes to see us as doctors, we do physical examination, treat their wounds, give them antibiotics, give them analgesics, and also give them drugs to prevent pregnancy. But unfortunately, some of them can actually get pregnant. And during this time, when they get pregnant, there are two things. Based on the fourth hadith of An-Nawawi collection, where it was written that the soul is breathed into the clot of blood in the womb at around 120 days, which is about 16 weeks or 4 months of gestation. And based on the fatwa that was given by the Islamic World League in Mecca in their 12th session on the 10th to 17th of February 1990 on the issue of abortion, they said if three Muslim physicians that are truthful can actually testify that the pregnancy is going to harm the woman's health, then it is allowed. Jurists in the Maliki and Shafi'i school of jurisprudence also do not allow abortion at any time except to save the life of the woman. So nonetheless, some jurists also allow abortion for social reasons like rape, whether when the continuation of the pregnancy will affect an innocent child, a child that is breastfeeding, or where a wet nurse is not available, and so on. But most scholars, because of the way Islam respects life, actually will only allow abortion for strong medical reasons. Under the Nigerian law, the law on abortion is actually restrictive. But recently, the Society of Gynecology and of Nigeria, together with the Federal Ministry of Health, sat down to actually bring out what are the things that can actually lead to, what are the things that are medically acceptable. Because the Nigerian law also says that you only allow abortion based on the health of the well-being and well-being of the mother. So it was the Society of Gynecologists actually brought out guidelines of what it means for the woman's health and well-being to be affected. And they actually put the pregnancy that is resulting from rape and incest to be one of the reasons where you can actually do an abortion. So by combining both the Islamic law and the Nigerian law, it is actually, you can actually infer that allowed for pregnancy to be results from rape or incest. Under prevention of rape and what has worked so far, the answer is that actually the punishment that has been given for rape has not been severe enough, because the punishment is actually supposed to serve as a deterrent. If it does not serve as a deterrent, it actually leads to the perpetration of this act. And that is what we've been seeing in Nigeria and all over the world recently. In Nigeria in 2015, there was a Senate bill that talked about life imprisonment for people that for rapists. And then under the Nigerian Criminal Code, Section 357 talks of life imprisonment for rapists and also 14 years imprisonment for attempted rape. These punishments are not enough. And recently in the Senate, again, they are still debating on life imprisonment. If we don't go ahead and give a very severe punishment of the perpetration of this rape. Recently, at a court of law in Kaduna said that a man should be hanged. He should be given death by hanging for raping a two-year-old child that died as a result of that rape. That is the kind of law that will actually form a deterrent. If you give life imprisonment, the person may be given amnesty later or be allowed bail and things like that. And it does not help anybody within the society, because it will actually continue the perpetration of this rape. On Thursday, in NTA News, the Minister of Information and the Ministry of Women Affairs also mentioned that between January and May of this year, there were 717 cases of rape reported, of which, if you look at it, it resulted in 143 cases every month and 5 every day. And remember that more than 80% of cases are not reported. So these are just the ones they are mentioning that have been reported. So you can imagine that there may be thousands that have not been reported. So be that as it may, what are the things that we can do to prevent it? One, the society needs to have a reorientation and to look at women not as sex objects, because that is one of the things. Women are now looked at as objects of sex, and that is the only thing you look at when you see a woman. So we should change our minds and know that women are meant to be respected and they are mothers of the society. And again, we need to take tarbiya very seriously, protecting our children. Whether you are a working class woman or not, you need to put strategies in your home in place to protect your child from being a baby up to the time before she gets married and leaves your home. Because 2 days ago in Nasarawa State, a three-month-old baby was raped. So it has gone beyond the issue of physical dressing, the way a woman looks and appearance. Early last year in ABU, a sister in hijab was raped. And if you look at the ones that were reported in the media, a sister, Taibat, that was raped in Ibadan recently and killed in her father's house, she was wearing hijab. So it goes beyond the issue of a woman's dressing being the reason for rape. So parents have to be very vigilant. As a mother, you need to take care of your children. Let them not be in any seclusion with anybody, even if it's their uncle, their brother, their cousins. They shouldn't be in seclusion with any child at any point in time. They should always be in a place where you can see them. And then for the adolescents, again, we need to look at what they're up to. The internet has given us so much access to a lot of information, and studies have shown that more than 20 to 50 million adolescents are addicted to pornography. So you need to know what your adolescent is going through, because some of these things give them a lot of sexual tension, and they need to carry out to express this sexual tension. And some of them look for the vulnerable targets, and that's why you find out the rape and dating, courtship that are prolonged. I think that well-dressed and goes to visit her fiancé, I'm going to get married to him and all that. There's a level to which that person can continue bearing the sexual tension, and sometimes it can actually lead to rape. And we, people that go to parties and all that, we need to see where our youths and our children are. Then, as much as possible, we should support marriage so that people have the legitimate route of expressing their sexual desires, and we should make it as easy as possible for people to get married. Then we should promote decent dressing and behavior among men and women. It shouldn't just be the women. Men nowadays also wear a lot of tight clothes. Women also dress such that they show all parts of their bodies. But the most important thing is the heart. Remember in Surah Al-A'raf, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, وَلِبَاسُ تَقْوَى ذَلِكَ خَيْرٍ, that it is the hijab of the heart that is more important. So irrespective of the dress, the most important thing is what is, remember to guard our modesty, dress according to what Islam said. Sisters should put on their hijab. Men should not wear clothes that will reveal their private parts, because nowadays the clothes of men are even so tight that you can actually see some of their private parts. So if we dress well, lower our gaze, guard our modesty, it will also help. Then we should also avoid alcohol and psychoactive drugs, substances, as well as aphrodisiacs. So many of, I'm sure you'll be surprised that I'm talking about alcohol. Studies have shown that during the month of Ramadan, the sales of alcohol is actually reduced. So who has been drinking it all this while? There are Muslims that actually drink alcohol. So many Muslims also take drugs like cocaine, marijuana, all sorts of locally mixed drugs now are used to make them feel high. That's what we call psychoactive substances. And also aphrodisiacs. If you go to our parks, you see local medicine vendors telling you about aphrodisiacs, how it will enhance sexual performance. Imagine taking those drugs and then not having a legitimate means of expressing that sexual tension. Definitely they will look for a soft target, which is actually women and then the children. Then again, as much as possible, we should meaningfully engage our youths, because being if you have an idle mind, it is actually the devil's workshop, and to make people to start thinking of all sorts of things, and rape is one of the things they can easily do because they don't have anything meaningful to do. So finally, I would say that the main thing is dua. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala be the one, is actually the person that is the ultimate protector of every person. And rape has reached an epidemic proportion in this country and in the whole world that we cannot give soft punishments. If we don't punishment that serves as a deterrent, agents should also wake up to their for support them to get prosecution.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We're very grateful, Prof, for this concise and precise presentation. It really touched on a number of, I know a lot of questions, so some comments will come around all this issue of punishment, disagreement from the past till the present time among the scholars. You also talked about causes and prevention of rape. Now, I think since Barrister Asologe is yet to be seen on the screen here, hope all is well. We would like to move to Dr. Amina Abu Bakar, the first lady, Niger State here. Now, I think just a brief profile about Doctor. I'm just meeting her for the first time, listening to her for the first time. Inshallah, your presentation also will last for 10 minutes. But before that, just to say something about Dr. Amina, for us to know who Dr. Amina is.
Dr. Amina Abubakar is a consultant obstetrics and gynecology with a master's degree in public health and advocates. An advocate for the reproductive health rights of women. She is the wife of the executive governor of Niger State and founder of RAISE Foundation, a non-governmental organization whose vision is of a Nigerian where no woman dies from pregnancy-related cases. Her work at the foundation has led her to become intimately involved with the plight of women with varying reproductive health issues, especially maternal mortality, women with obstetric fistula, and breast and cervical cancer. The flagship intervention for the foundation, however, is ensuring women deliver safely in the hospital. She does this by advocacy, sensitization, training of skilled birth attendants, providing safe delivery kits for pregnant women, and providing emergency tricycle ambulances to communities for conveying pregnant women to the hospital for delivery. Her foundation unveiled the Cancer Screening Center for the first of its kind in Niger State, dedicated to early detection and preventive therapy of breast and cervical cancer. The foundation has conducted free breast cancer screening for over 10,000 women and 8,000 women for cervical cancer and has helped with treatment of those who require further diagnosis and treatment. She serves on the World Health Organization's Technical Advisory Group for the Cervical Cancer Elimination Initiative. She is passionate about projects that directly affect women positively and is involved in empowerment schemes for women and education for the girl child. She has also established RAISE Foundation Skill Acquisition Center, where women and youth have been trained in tailoring, embellishments, beadwork, and leatherwork. She has done several researches on different aspects of maternal mortality and reproductive health. She has done some work on unsafe abortion, family planning, and primary health care centers. She further strengthens her knowledge by undertaking courses and attending seminars throughout the globe. She holds membership of Nigerian Medical Association, NMA, Medical Dental Council of Nigeria, Medical Women Association of Nigeria, MWAN, and the Society of Gynecologists and Obstetrics of Nigeria, SOGON. She's also a member of West African College of Surgeons and a member of African Institute of Public Health Professionals, AIPHP. Thank you, Dr. Amina, as you join us on this very important discussion.
Thank you very much for having me. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor for me to be among this distinguished panel. I'm here basically for my skills as a medical doctor. I am in no way a scholar. So you would excuse me for saying that putting me in that group of scholars is an exaggeration of sorts. But nonetheless, I'm happy to be here and I'm honored to be able to give this presentation. Now, I don't know how I'm going to cram all that I'm supposed to say in 10 minutes, but I will do my best to see that I can do justice to the topics in front of me. I'm supposed to talk about the care of a rape patient and also how we can improve the reporting and prosecution of rape. Now, this very serious issue is one that is so traumatic and has lasting psychological and even physical effects on the victims and the individuals affected. When we're talking about the care of a rape patient, we have to assess the patient in five basic ways. The first one is to assess the patient for physical injuries with special focus on the genitalia. Then secondly, we have to do a psychological assessment and give the victim a psychological support. And then at the same time, we need to do a pregnancy assessment and to prevent the pregnancy. And then we need to evaluate the victim and treat as appropriate what we have found at that particular time. And then the fifth, and which is also one of the most important aspects that can ensure prosecution, is to provide forensic evaluation of the victim. Now, the proper evaluation of a rape victim, it can take from anything between 3 to 6 hours, because it is a thorough examination that has to be done that should leave nothing unturned. And it is very important to do it at that particular time to get the evidence required to be able to prosecute the perpetrator, which is why you have to, it takes a long time to be able to do that. And at the time that the examination is going on, you have to be able to make sure you collect the evidence and then make sure that you safeguard the evidence so that it is not interfered with, that will affect your the prosecution of the perpetrator. One of the most important aspects that allows us to lose the cases of rape is from lack of evidence. So the chain of the evidentiary material is very important. Now, when doing the assessment of the patient, you have to assess the physical state of the woman. In a lot of cases, women can have can present with fractures, soft tissue injuries. Sometimes you might even need to admit those patients to be able to treat them properly. In majority of cases, rape victims or sexual assault victims, we would have external injuries, but then you also have the internal injuries that nobody can see, which is where you need psychological support. Now, for the care of a rape patient or a sexual assault victim, it needs to be done by trained professionals. This is the most important aspect of it. You need trained professionals that will examine the patient, who will be able to provide the proper examination, the treatment and the support the patient or the victim is going to require. So physical examination will take care of, you'll be able to find out where the victim is injured, and you'll be able to provide the correct treatment for the patient. Now, while doing the physical examination, you take samples for forensic evaluation. Now, the samples that you need to take include the victim's clothes. You need to take swabs of the mouth and the private parts. You need to take swabs from the vagina, even from the rectum. You need to take scalp and hair samples from the patient. You need to take blood samples, and you also need to take saliva samples. All the samples are obtained so that tests are conducted on them, mostly to look for spermatozoa or sperm, and also to check for DNA evidence in these samples. Then we also need to do tests for sexually transmitted diseases as well as pregnancy tests. Now, to be clear, the pregnancy tests and the sexual transmitted infections screening is, number one, to rule out that the patient has those things at the time that the patient was raped, and also to have evidence in case the woman does get pregnant or develops those infections following the rape. So you make those, you take those tests, and those tests usually you test for the patient for HIV, hepatitis B, chlamydia, gonorrhea. These are the commonest sexually transmitted diseases that we have. And then following that, you now give the patient treatment as appropriate based on the assessment that you have done. Now, antibiotic therapy, prophylaxis against sexually transmitted diseases. We have what we call the post-exposure prophylaxis, which is drugs that you give for to prevent the woman from developing HIV from the perpetrator in case the patient has, in case the perpetrator has HIV, as well as hepatitis B vaccination for women who have not, or for victims who have not had the vaccination prior to then. Then, of course, any other injuries that the patient might have had will be treated based on your assessment. Now, following this, you now need to do, as you are doing this, the patient needs to be counseled extensively at the time that you are seeing the patient. Because rape is a case where there is so much emotional distress that is associated with it. Now, in the short term, or rather in the acute stage, just where you have those injuries, but in the long term or later on, that's where you have most of the psychological stresses presenting in these patients. Symptoms of these psychological problems range from a gamut of things that start from anger, fear, anxiety. They can even have physical pain. They have feelings of shame and guilt. They have sleep disturbances, and then they have intrusive thoughts. Some in extreme cases, depending on the kind of sexual assault that the patient has suffered, they can have post-traumatic stress disorder, and they can go into depression to the extent that they can even have suicidal thoughts. So these aspects have to be managed properly from the very beginning. So at the time a rape victim is being seen, that rape victim has to be assessed and counseled properly by a trained mental health specialist. So the patient should be referred to that specialist. Following the initial assessment of the patient, she or the victim should be seen 2 weeks later. And at that time, physical examination is conducted. She's also being given an opportunity to be counseled again so that you assess her psychological state at that particular time. And then a repeat of some of the tests are done at that particular time also. So it is very important that patients are being, or rather victims are being taken care of very well initially from the time that they are discovered. Now, in order to improve the reporting and the prosecution of perpetrators, we need to have a support system, an organized support system that provides access for victims to be assessed and to be given the proper care at the time that they are assaulted. Now, in Nigeria, we have these centers called Sexual Assault Reproductive Centers, SAC centers. Not all states in Nigeria have it, but some states have it, including Niger State. In Kaduna, Niger State, I know, have those referral centers. Now, what these centers have are a team of professionals, doctors, nurses, counselors, and police who are trained specifically to take care of the rape or sexual assault victims. Each one has their own way of has to perform their own duties properly in terms of taking the evidences, taking the history of the patient, of the victim, and then doing the proper exam across the board in all the local governments or in all hospitals, I would say, where patients can present with, where victims can present with these problems. Then you have a good chance of actually getting these cases reported and getting the correct evidence that will prosecute the perpetrators. So it is a very big issue that here in Nigeria, we have very few SAC centers. And even those places that we do have the SAC centers, they are not fully working in full capacity to be able to address the issue that we're seeing now. The cases of rape that we're seeing now are so much, and what we have on ground is not enough to be able to handle the issues. So basically, you need trained personnel in the hospitals, in the police stations, as well as in these sexual reproductive, these sexual assault referral centers, to be able to assess and get, to be able to get women to present to these centers and give their reports. One of the major factors that we have that stops victims from reporting their cases is the way and manner in which their cases are treated, either from the police when they report it and or from the hospitals themselves where they now present themselves. So we have to look at those issues and see how we can improve access for victims so that they're able to feel safe and report them and report cases of rape when it happens to them. And then, like I mentioned, with regard to the forensic evidence collection, once you are able to collect the evidence correctly, then you have a better chance of getting prosecutions. Now, the earlier you are able to get the evidence, the better and the more reliable your results are. So if a woman was raped within a few hours and she happens to report, then the evidence that you get from that woman is more reliable than one that you would get if she presents a day or two later, when she would have had her bath or she would have discarded the clothes that she had worn at the time that the assault happened. So these are important issues that need to be addressed. In general, we have to look at the way society looks at rape in general to be able to prevent it and to be able to get the perpetrators called to book. Now, if we look at it as a general way of prevention, I think we need to look at it in five major areas. We have to look at the legislation. We have to look at what the government is doing both at the federal and the state level. We have to look at what the communities, our societies are looking at it from. For example, what are the religious leaders, community leaders, and the communities themselves? How do they view rape and rape victims, and how are we managing them in those our communities? And then lastly, what is the education? What is the educational system doing in teaching our children values, especially boys, on how to respect women and how to make sure they respect their privacies and how they do not commit this heinous crime? In order to prevent rape, these four things need to be taken as a whole and dealt with in that particular way so that we are able to prevent these cases from happening. Legislation is meant to punish the perpetrator, but it also serves as a deterrent. So if we're able to ensure that the laws that we have already that are on ground are implemented properly as they should, that I feel we should be able to deter our perpetrators from committing these crimes. I think in a nutshell, that is what I have to say, but I can expand a bit more with questions that come along. I don't want to take too much of the time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jazakumullahu khairan. And of course, I've seen a lot of questions coming in, I think, towards Dr. Amina. Inshallah, I hope you will be there to answer some of those questions. We actually deliberate in this kind of combination because, a principle in Islamic jurisprudence says, Al-hukmu ala shay'in far'un an tasawwurihi. Having the likes of Professor Hajara Umar, the likes of Dr. Amina, will of course enable scholars to even come up with whatever rulings or Islamic verdicts they wanted to bring concerning this issue. We really appreciate your presentation. May Allah reward you. While we still expect Barrister Nuruddin Asunoge, I would like to move to the next panelist, Professor Ahmad Bello Dogarawa. Professor Ahmad Bello Dogarawa is a professor in the Department of Accounting, Ahmad Bello University, Zaria. He's a certified management trainer. He's alumnus of Al-Azhar University, Cairo, from where he obtained a certificate in Islamic religious sciences, Dawa to be precise, and Islamic economics. So he was a founding member of League of Scholars, Imam and Preachers in Sahel, with headquarters in Algier. So he is also a member of research team on ethno-religious crisis in Northern Nigeria under Jamaat Nasrul Islam, JNI, national headquarters. He's a member of JAI's advisory committee of experts. He is currently the director of finance at IIIT Central Nigeria office. Professor Dogarawa has traveled to a number of countries. If I don't know any other, I know that of Mauritania, just of recent where we met. He's traveled to Niger and Ghana, and he do have some of his constant training and program in these two neighboring countries. Professor Ahmad Dogarawa, I believe with his broad knowledge of Islamic sciences in particular, will also contribute, I think, to this very important topic. Professor Dogarawa, you're welcome. You have 10 minutes
for the presentation. Ustaz Ismail. Alhamdulillah. Salatu wassalamu ala Rasulullah wa ala alihi wa ashabihi wa man walahu wa ba'd. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Let me start with the ways of improving reporting and prosecution of rape. Since our Sheikh, Dr. Bashir Ali Umar, has spoken at length on the issue of rape, its types, how to establish it, and so on. And then our two sisters, Professor Hajara and Dr. Amina, have also spoken on the issue of rape, especially with regards to the medical aspects of it. So let me quickly go into the issue of ways of improving reporting and prosecuting for prosecution of rape. First, I think it is important to critically examine the issue of how rape is established, because as Dr. Bashir has explained, scholars have actually considered rape as maybe the same way with zina in terms of how to establish or prove it, and then even the punishment for rape. But few scholars advocating that rape should be looked at from the perspective of Iraba, as he has mentioned. And I think, although it is difficult to, in all cases, allude to the fact that rape should just be considered as a form of Iraba, because in Iraba, there has to be a threat. And in some cases, as it has been reported separately, and over the years, sometimes the claim for rape may actually emanate as a result of hate between a woman and a man, especially with regard or respect to her former fiancé. Sometimes this claim may come up just revenge, or maybe sometimes for the sake of fame. It has also been reported severally. It has been proven beyond reasonable doubt that sometimes there are instances where women may claim rape or being victims of rape with regards to either rich people or influential people in the society in order to blackmail them. So because of some of these reasons, though they are not the main cases, or they have not constituted the majority cases, yet because of this, considering rape as Hiraba, outrightly, will be a little bit difficult. However, when we look at it from the angle of married women, as well as minors and toddlers being victims of rape, then in that case, one would wonder if maybe rape is not considered as maybe Hiraba, whether considering it as a form of zina would actually help in solving the problem. Because for a minor, a toddler, that is not to actually be desired by any normal person. Or maybe in some cases, married women who might actually be forced into, who might be abducted and taken to maybe the bush or other places and then be raped. If we consider that kind of maybe act as a form of zina, even though the scholars that should be looking as a form of zina also added that when it is accompanied with a threat or maybe abduction, it should also take the form of hiraba in addition to zina. But then for minors, I think looking at it from the viewpoint of hiraba is probably more in tandem with our reality as it is today than just looking at it from the angle of hiraba, from the angle of zina. But then it is also important to remember that in all cases, establishing rape through modern techniques, DNA tests, forensic tests, and other tests that medical personnel carry out in order to establish the case of rape may not necessarily, lead to the issue of implementing, punishment in the form of had for zina, because these are called circumstantial evidences. And because they are called circumstantial evidences, it may be difficult for a judge to sentence, the rapist to maybe punishment of either 100 lashes or the issue of stoning or death punishment, as the case may be, because they are called to a great extent by the fuqaha as circumstantial evidence. And on the basis of Idra ul-Hudud bishubuhati, it may be difficult for a judge to say, okay, 100 lashes should be given to a rapist if it is based on circumstantial evidence. So I think this is also an area that maybe scholars need to look at it again, and then maybe examine it again to see whether, I mean, this circumstantial evidence can take the form of real evidence rather than just circumstantial evidence. And then I think also there is a need for societal orientation, as Professor Hajara has rightly pointed out, because sometimes the victim may actually be in a state of quagmire, whereby one, it is not actually encouraged from the viewpoint of Sharia for one to go and open up and say, I have been raped, in view of the fact that some of the social ills that will follow, or the kind of trauma that the person will go through, may actually be more harmful than probably the benefit that is maybe envisaged. So this society itself needs to be reoriented in view of the fact that people who are victims of rape may form, may face stigmatization, and people may see them as people who are wayward, you know, people who are not, decent, people who are morally bankrupt, not knowing or not actually minding the fact that they are victims. Sometimes people who are victims, especially grown-up women, may be seen by members of the society as people who have actually given themselves, you know, cheaply, and after it has happened, they now want to blackmail the person, and therefore they are now calling on the authorities to investigate, or maybe screaming, saying that the person has actually raped them without their consent. So I think this societal orientation is very important if we really want to improve our reporting. And then also there's a need for speedy, you know, dispensation of rape cases, because the case of Kaduna that has been cited is a good one. But then we have to also remember the problems of our judicial system, whereby cases are not dispensed, quickly. And then even where they are dispensed and judgment pronounced, now the period of appeal is there. After the period of appeal, since it is death sentence, it is at the mercy of the executive governor of the state. So if he did not sign, you know, the judgment, if he did not actually give his approval for the judgment to be, for the sentence to be implemented, what it means is that the person that is the convict will remain, you know, under the custody, or in the custody of the Nigerian prison service. He will be imprisoned and be awaiting the execution of the punishment. And that can take several years. And who knows, after maybe this administration, whether the incoming government would actually want to do that, or for political reasons, they may not want to sign that warrant or that execution or judgment for the sentence to be executed. So I think this is also very important. And in this case, there might be the need for people, or rather for the Ummah, to actually, you know, go back to the members of House of Assemblies to actually, or rather the legislature, so that they can look at this issue of delayed execution of punishment, because the governor can also, you know, pardon the person. He can pardon the convicts and say one day that he has been pardoned, and nothing can be done as far as the legal system of Nigeria is concerned. So I think this is also an issue that probably need to be looked at. Then on the issue of the challenge of pregnancy, it has been explained by Professor Hajara that in view of the importance of life, because it's one of the five basic necessities that the Sharia of Islam has actually advocated for and is focused on, because life has to be protected. So therefore, when there is pregnancy, it is always a very big issue to be resolved. First, at the early days of the pregnancy, by the opinion of the majority of scholars, if there is a need for the pregnancy to be aborted, especially in its early days, it may be aborted. However, once the soul has been breathed into, you know, the embryo, it becomes a very difficult thing. Many scholars, or rather greater majority of scholars, are of the view that it cannot be, you know, aborted. And they use as evidence the hadith of Ghamidi, the Ghamidi woman, who actually came to the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and confessed to committing zina, but she was already pregnant. The Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam did not instruct her to go and abort the pregnancy. Rather, he actually delayed or deferred out of which she gave birth to the fetus. and after giving birth to the fetus, he even asked her to go back until the child is weaned before the punishment was actually executed. So based on this, many scholars said once a soul has been breathed into the embryo, it is actually not permissible for that pregnancy to be aborted. However, some scholars are also of the view that if we know, and this is what is real in our society, that that pregnancy, if allowed to continue and the embryo or the fetus are delivered, if will that will lead to a kind of hate between the woman, that is the mother, and the fetus, who would may probably want to get rid of it because she will hate it, and then the stigmatization that will follow after the child must have been, you know, delivered, because people in the society will look him as will look at him as a bastard, not even minding that it was a case of rape. People will forget about that, and you would be denied a lot of things in our own society in Nigeria. Based on this, some scholars are of the view that there can be some kind of concession for the woman to abort that pregnancy, provided based on the advice of reliable experts and medical experts, it will not lead to a harm, you know, on the part of the woman. It will not lead to any harm on the part of the woman. It may be aborted. I think this is another area that our scholars, the Fuqaha, need to also look at it and see maybe if there is anything that actually can be agreed upon as far as abortion of this kind of pregnancy is concerned. Then on the issue of what to do in order to actually, you know, prevent rape in our society, it is very important that we need to go back to the basics. There should be proper Islamic education and good parenting. And then also there is the need to encourage decent relationship and also decent dressing. Because the kind of relationship that we see now happening between men and women, grown-up men and grown-up women, is actually to some extent indecent. So we need to promote decent relationship between men and women, and then we also need to encourage, you know, decent dressing, because the way some girls are moving around, roaming the streets with a lot of you know, indecency, is also one of the factors. Though it's not the main factor, it's not the only factor, because if we call it the main factor or the only factor, then what happened to the issue of raping, you know, a minor, a 3 months old baby, a 2-year-old baby, and girl, and so on. So, but it is really one of the main contributing factors which we really need to address, the issue of decency. And then also censoring of contents in the TV, songs, because we even have songs that people listen to, and in some of these songs,
you find that it's not
held, and so on. Okay, we need to also look at that. And then there's also the issue of sticking out, you know, against rape, and also making it a part of our, you know, daily talks in our khutbah, Juma khutbah, in our study cycles, in our public lectures. We need to actually emphasize, because one of the, you know, five basic necessities, you know, protection of dignity and honor. And definitely rape is a violation of dignity and honor. So therefore, we need to emphasize on that. And then there is also the need to emphasize, we need to talk, you know, constantly on the importance of, you know, makasib, because in the area of makasib, we know that protection of honor and dignity is key, is one of the five basic necessities. So we need to, you know, encourage scholars, ulama, teachers of Islamic schools, to always talk about the importance of makasib and why it should actually be observed. Mm-hmm. And then we need to encourage the issue of speedy dispensation of rape cases, because as I mentioned, is one of the contributory factors. And then lastly, there is the issue of early marriage. Although marriageable age varies, you know, across cultures, customs, and countries, but it is important that we look at this issue very critically. We have a situation whereby a lady, a grown-up lady, would be asking her parents to marry her out or marry her off, but the parent will insist until you finish your degree, until you bag this, until you obtain this and that. And this lady would actually make herself very, you know, accessible to maybe her friends, male friends, her colleagues in school and so on, and in the name of a fiancé, you know, relationship, fiancé relationship, you find that they will become very intimate with seclusion, free mixing, and so on, and that may lead to the devilish act of rape. So I think some of these things, if we look at them critically and reassess them, probably it would help, inshallah, in no small measure in curtailing the problem of rape in our society. Wallahu ta'ala ala wa alam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, Professor Dulgarawa. One thing, I think Tony...
Assalamu alaikum. Whenever... Sorry, I can't hear. We can't hear you. We can't hear you. Yes.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes,
we can hear you.
Thank you very much. I'm just thanking Professor Dogarawa and trying to say that whenever his name is mentioned, I personally hardly remember the accounting side of it. So I remember him with Islamic sciences more. We have a number of questions here. And unfortunately, we've been in touch with Asunobe, but up till now, we hear silence. We hope all is well. We have a number of questions. I think we have to go back to our panelists. For the audience, permit me to go through the questions first. So before we come to those who may be having one or a few comments, inshallah. If a question has been addressed, I will not, you know, read that again, because I can see some questions there. They have been addressed by us, many of the panelists, so I will not read them again. The first question says, can rape happen among married couple? I think two people asked this question. Between the husband and wife, can rape happen among them? And he's saying, if yes, how is it established? And what is the punishment? I think three questions combined. I don't know, maybe Dr. Bashir?
Okay, under the Sharia, there cannot be technically rape between a husband and a wife, but there can be transgression. A husband, because it is not regarded as conceivable that for him to take what is rightful by the Sharia from his wife, that it could be said to be without her consent. So that is not technically rape, but there could be a case of transgression. That is, if he forcibly harms her in the attempt to have sexual intercourse with her, then she has a right to claim compensation. Or if he knows that she is, by the nature of her body, she is not yet fit for sexual intercourse, like it happens when people marry girls that are of a tender age. If the fuqaha clearly state that the husband cannot have sexual intercourse with her till when she has reached to the level of a physical ability to engage in the act of sexual intercourse. If without doing that he does it and then there is some harm on her, then he has to pay compensation. In fact, according to Malik, if that led to her death, he would also be killed by qisas. He will also be hanged. Which incidentally I wanted to comment regarding, it's a bit digressing, the rule of the Kaduna State Court for hanging the person who had who raped an underaged girl, a toddler or a two-year-old girl. We should realize that there are two aspects to that. There is the aspect of the rape, which is considered as zina. Then there is the aspect of the transgression, al-i'tida, because by the transgression, he had caused her to lose her life, and the judgment is qisas. So the qisas is given prominence over the act of the zina that he has done, because you have two acts of crime coming together. So the one that is given priority is the act of qisas, even though he might be liable to death by stoning if he's an adulterer. But the judge, in his wisdom, he realized the constraints that are there in exercising the hard punishment, and also in seeing that in terms of severity, the severity of the crime of manslaughter, the severity of the crime of murder is more serious than the severity of the crime of illicit sexual intercourse. So we should always realize that in the case of rape, there is this aspect of al-i'tida, which is why all the fuqaha, they mentioned it on under the chapter of transgression. Yes.
Jazakumullah khair. Before I go to others, I would still like to ask Dr. Bashir this question. The same person is saying, what is the juristic ruling about getting the victim married to the perpetrator through arrangements by both families? How would that issue from that incident be considered if she happened to have been impregnated as a result?
Well, that is a totally different issue. I mean, it is not the question of crime and judgment. It is a social issue, which if that is, there is nothing that will prevent the accused from getting married to the victim if they so arrange. And but the question of the, and also regarding the question of the pregnancy, the opinion, even though it is a minority opinion, based on the issue of istilhaq, it is permissible for somebody who knows that he had fathered, who knows that he was the cause of the pregnancy of a woman outside marriage, to claim and accept the child, and it will be recognized. This opinion is the opinion that is strongly supported by many scholars, even though it is outside the four madahib, the four schools of fiqh. And it has a lot of maslaha in it. There is a lot of benefit for it, rather than to leave the child without a father or as an illegitimate child, denied the chance to inherit his father. If the father, knowing that he is the biological father, if he accepts him through the procedure of istilhaq, then he becomes the legal father according to the Sharia. So these are social issues, and I thought we are just talking about jurisprudential issues here. Wallahu ta'ala a'lam.
Jazakumullah khairan. I will still come back to you, but let me quickly go to another question, which I think it's for, I think, the Dr. Amina or Professor Hajara. Somebody is saying, what is the effective channel for a rape victim to report a case in Nigeria? Then, as a rape is not restricted to female, what is the medical procedures if the victim is male?
Okay. The victim of a rape or a sexual assault in Nigeria, the best way to do it is to, if you have a sexual if there's a sexual assault referral center in your state or your locality, that's where you should go, because the police, the medical personnel, and the counselors are there in the same place. But if that is not possible, you need to report to the police first, so that the police are aware, and then you are taken directly to the hospital for physical examination and treatment. Usually what happens in the hospital is the police brings the cases to us in the hospital. And then we now do the physical examination and provide the police with the physical, with the evidence. However, if you also report to the hospital, at that particular point in the hospital, they will ask you to contact the police, so that the police and the doctors work hand in hand together. So it depends on where you are and what is available for you. So this is one of the problems that we have. We need to have a more organized system that patients know that this is the way in which you can go. But basically in Nigeria, these are the two ways in which you can do it, either SAC center or go directly to the police. From there, the police requires you to the hospital, or to the hospital, and then the police are contacted from there. Then the procedure for the male, if a male is raped, is basically the same. The procedures are the same. The only difference is because the males are anatomically different from women. So that's where you can have the differences in terms of how you do the examination. But the processes of doing the physical examinations, doing the tests, is basically the same for both male and female, except for where you have the differences because of the sex of the victim.
Okay, thank you very much. It seems Professor Hajara is not here. One question is directed to her. Let me go to another one. Somebody is saying a question to the first panelist, Dr. Bashir. Is there a Islamic law for false claim of rape? That's to Dr. Bashir.
Yeah, a false claim of rape, if it is established, the provision is that the claimant will receive the punishment of slander, al-qadhaf, that is false accusation, and slander, which is 80 strokes of which is 80 lashes, 80 okay. strokes of the cane. Because the one who is unable to present evidence that he has been that he's a victim of rape, and he points an accusing finger to somebody claiming that he is the rapist, if he fails to provide evidence, then his act is equal, is tantamount to al-qadhaf, which is slander. Okay, Ismail.
Okay, thank you very much, Jazakumullah Khairan. And then another question, when a man is the victim, the one being raped, what is this called? I think it's like somebody asked this question also, like do we call in a situation where a man is raped, what do we call that?
If it is by another man, it is liwab, it is sodomy. It is sodomy if it is done by another man, but there is also at the same time there is the case of al-i'tida, which is transgression on his right. So the perpetrator will receive the punishment of sodomy, and then if there is harm, he will also get compensation for the harm that he has inflicted on the victim. If the perpetrator is a woman, that is the one that is regarded as inconceivable, because except of course if where he is forced to have sexual intercourse with another woman, that is the woman threatening him with arms that he must have sexual intercourse with her, in which case he is not regarded as a rapist, and the woman will be punished for the punishment of illicit sexual intercourse of zina, and where the one who compels him to commit the act of rape on to commit the act of zina on another person, if he is not a sultan. It is not, according to the Hanafiya, they say that it is inconceivable for a man to be compelled to do sexual intercourse, illicit sexual intercourse, except if the person who is compelling him is an authority, that is a government. But if it is somebody that is not a government, somebody who has by the force of arms, he compels him to commit that, then he will do it. And then if he does it, then the punishment will be on the one who compelled him. And if there is any harm, any monetary harm, that he is supposed to pay, which normally it accrues to the woman who has been raped, she has to be given monetary compensation that is equivalent to the dowry that is normally given for people of her status. The dowry, he will pay the dowry, and then he will have the right to take it back from the one who compelled him. All this, the Fuqaha, they mentioned it.
Jazakumullah khairan. I don't know, maybe let me move to Dr. Amina again, because I think this question is specific to her. Please, for all the treatment mentioned, who pays for the costs of treatments?
Which treatment? Treatment?
Think, yeah, the rape.
The rape?
Yes.
Right now in the health system, the way the health system works in Nigeria, most of it is out of pocket. So unfortunately for now, usually what happens, the patient usually pays, or the patient's relation usually pays for the treatment, which is something I think that we all, but however, in the sexual assault referral center, the patients are treated for free. So if you have a sexual assault referral center in your state, that the treatment, the assessment, and the tests are done free for the patients. But if you were to go to the normal hospital or the normal police station, everything that you are going to do would be done out of pocket by yourself. But for those centers, so which is why we're advocating for all the state governments to increase the number of SAC centers that you have in their state, because this will go a long way in encouraging women or victims to present themselves, because they know that they will have all the services that they require and they don't need to pay for it. Okay. You've got mute again now.
Sorry. This is going to Professor Dogara and Dr. Amina again. Say briefly, how do we address the issue of stigma that is associated with the raped victim in our society, where the rape is mostly blamed? Thank you.
I don't know if Dr. Dogara is going to take it.
Well, I think, as we both mentioned, the first thing is societal orientation.
Yeah.
Honestly, people need to understand that it is not good to stigmatize victims of rape. First, this person is a victim. He or she was raped against his or her wish. It may even lead to other things like physical injury and so on. And yet, instead of being, you know, compassionate with the person, and also be sympathetic to his or her cause, we are now stigmatizing him or her, saying that maybe it is willfully, there's consent, and that it is only a way of trying to cover up the shame. That is why the person is presenting it as a case of rape. I think this societal orientation is very important. People need to understand that in Islam, people who happen to be victims of rape are supposed to, I mean, we are supposed to show them some kindness, and then we are supposed to feel the way they feel. Because as Muslims, we should know that the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam has informed us that one is not a true believer until he likes for his brother what he likes for himself. And we do not like evil to happen to us, so we should not also like evil to happen to others. And then we are not supposed to also celebrate, you know, the offender by way of stigmatizing the victim. This is important for people to know. And then I think we are supposed to use, you know, all the media we have, all the platforms we can use in educating people on this important issue. And then also it may be helpful, you know, on the basis of ta'zir, if people deliberately stigmatize victims of rape, especially where it has been established that they are true victims of rape, and probably the case even taken to court and it was established there, and then yet they are stigmatized, I think, in my own opinion, it will not be out of place for such people who stigmatize others to actually be, you know, reported to the authorities. And then it's expected that the authorities should investigate. Once it is established that these people are stigmatized on account of them being victims of rape, then I think the necessary you know, punishment should be given in the name of ta'zir so that it can serve as deterrence to others. Wallahu alam. Naam, Ustaz Ismail. Ustaz Ismail, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm there. Thank you very much. Jazakumullahu khairan. This goes to the third presenter, which I believe Dr. Amina. Question says, can it be a routine for the victim to receive drugs to protect her from getting HIV?
No, it's not routine. When a victim has been, now it even depends on the type of sexual assault. If a patient has been raped, which means there's been penetration in the act, there is a small risk that if the perpetrator is HIV positive, then there's a small risk that the victim might be infected. So in those cases, that is when you give the woman or the victim the HIV prophylaxis. And the prophylaxis is it's a series of drugs, about three or four drugs that are given for 1 month exactly. So apart from that situation, you don't give the patients a routine. So if a person has been assaulted and there's no penetration and there's no ejaculation, things like that, you do not need to actually give the HIV prophylaxis.
Thank you, ma'am. This question goes to Professor Hajara. Say salamu alaikum. Due to the fact that some security agent will want to delay victims from getting justice due to guiding policy reports, etc., before getting them to see a doctor for the rape test, what will you advise victims to do as first aid to get those initial blood samples, sperm, etc., available on their own before seeing a doctor in case security agent try to delay or victims need to attend to some needs like passing out urine, etc.? I think is directing this to Professor Hajara, but I believe Dr. Amina also can come in on this question.
Please, can you repeat the question again?
The question is, due to the fact that some security agent will want to delay victims from getting justice due to guiding policies, reports, etc., so before getting them to see a doctor for the rape test, what will you advise victims to do as first aid to get those initial blood samples, sperm, etc., available on their own before seeing a doctor in case security agent try to delay? Or victims need to attend to some need, like passing out urine?
Okay, I would actually like to discourage anybody trying to take any sample on themselves by themselves, because there are specific ways in which these samples are taken. Now, just because the patient passes urine doesn't mean that it loses you. Yes, it will be important that you get samples as soon as possible. But where the patient passes urine, there are other samples that you can take that will be able to give you evidence. Like I said, when I was doing my presentation, you have specially trained people to take this evidence. So by actually going somewhere else to take this evidence, you are tainting the evidence that you already might have, and that can negatively affect your case at the end of the day. So my advice would be that just go to the appropriate place, no matter what delay you might have in that at that particular area, you are still in the correct place and you would eventually get that evidence taken. And usually what happens is that if the rape happens immediately and you do go, the evidence remains for like at least 24 hours. Of course, if the earlier, a few hours is better, but even if it is within 24 hours, evidence can still be obtained and it will still be viable. So I would discourage anybody from going anywhere else that doesn't have the qualified personnel to be able to take those samples.
Thank you. I don't know whether Professor Hajara would like to add something. Professor Hajara, seems the network is Professor Hajara. Okay, I think a network issue over there. I just have to select few questions because we are running out of time. I see a lot of people raising their hands. I'm very sorry for that. Maybe let me just take few, two or three questions more. Then I will give room for one or two participants to also comment or make their own comments. Then we round up, inshallah. A question here to Dr. Bashir. Islamically, can a country put death sentence as the punishment for rape?
Well, if it is the opinion of the scholars there, if they reach a consensus in regarding rape as irada, which is the opinion of some scholars, even though it is a very minority number of scholars, irada could be definitely one of the punishment for irada is capital punishment. On the other hand, even if it is not regarded as irada, and they decide to regard it as a ta'zir punishment, not a hard punishment, because even though it has aspects of zina, it is not exactly zina in all respects. So if adding the taking into cognizance the transgression aspect of that is there in rape, if they make the rape to be a capital punishment based on ta'zir, it is also permissible. But as pointed out by Professor Dogarawa, there are many aspects to it. Much as we are always looking at the perpetrator, we should also look at what the victim, the manipulation that could be done by the supposed victim, especially where the victim is not a minor, where the victim is an adult, and the possibility of making use of the claim to rape to achieve an ulterior motive, that should be taken into consideration, which normally juries they do, and judges they always take that into consideration. Therefore, making a blanket judgment is really it is actually not proper. It is better to leave it the way the jurists have classified it, and then you leave it to the individual judgment of the qadi and also the context of the case, the events surrounding the case, for the qadi to take the best judgment. Wallahu ta'ala.
Thank you. Just because of time, I will take one more question. Apology to others. I think this maybe just needs a few comments. The person is saying, it is humble view to the government to address the problem of drug abuse in our society, especially sex enhancer, sold almost everywhere freely. I don't know whether Professor Hajara will have comment on this. Somebody advising government to look at the area of a problem of drug abuse, and especially sex enhancer sold almost everywhere freely. That's his own comment. Professor Hajara, it's like a network is somehow there. Let me move this to Dr. Amina. Do you have any comment on this?
That government should move on.
Yeah, the government to address the problem of drug abuse, especially sex enhancers sold almost everywhere, you know, freely. I don't know how.
Well, you know something, drug abuse actually happens to be one of the things that fuels rape in our society. Insurgency, rape thing and this kidnapping thing, as well as drug abuse. Because what happens is when you have an addict, they lose their sense of propriety, and they lose their boundaries. So we have found, because you know, with the work, the Northern Governors Wives Forum work, one of the advocacy that we have been working on is drug abuse. So this is a topic that we are quite aware about, and it's true, drug abuse does fuel all forms of illicit activity, including rape. So the work that we do on advocacy is to encourage government to increase the prevention and the treatment, the prevention of drug abuse, number one, and also for the treatment of people who are addicted to drugs. So yes, I think that was a very good point. And I think a lot of us are doing work towards that to ensure that we have rehabilitation centers, but most importantly, to ensure that there are prevention programs within schools and within communities that will encourage youth from, or rather discourage youth from even attempting to start using drugs. Because the problem with drug abuse is once a person has attempted once, it becomes a problem. So the prevention programs that we are working on are tailored to preventing people from even starting taking drugs in the first place. So yes, I believe that that would be a good way in which we can curb some of the effects, but not all of it. It's just one of the various factors that have been fueling the incidence of rape in the country.
Thank you very much. Maybe let me take the last one, and then we just stop here, inshallah. I believe some of us, we know some of the presenters. If you know them, I think you feel a clarification of some of their presentation. You can contact them. I'm not giving their contact to anybody, but I'm just saying for those who know them. So I think you have your way. Because a lot of questions I can see to Dr. Bashir in particular, maybe Islamic perspective on all this issue of Hirada, what do you mean by this and that? Let me just take the last one, then we thank everybody.
Ustaz Ismail, can I suggest before you go to the last one? Because there are quite a number of very important questions, and maybe you could give an address from the Dawah Institute that the questions can be addressed to, and then the answers can be forwarded through that email address, and then the people can get their answers.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I think we take note of that, inshallah. The last question here, I think it's small, but I think this is just what my eye can. It's saying, how can the society make marriage simple? I think one of the preventive measures somebody raised, how can the society make the marriage simple? I try to know.
That is for, the question is for who? It's for Sheikh, it's for Professor Dogarawa.
I think, but I think, Akramullah, you can take that question, inshallah.
No, that is for you, because you are on the way to increasing, to marry more wives. Fadal, Fadal, bro.
Mashallah. Making marriage simple sometimes is a very difficult question. Sometimes people ask this question not minding the fact that it is a two-way thing. For young men, when they want to, you know, get married, they start thinking of simplicity in marriage, because they are the ones to actually, you know, shoulder the responsibility of marrying a woman of their choice. On the other hand, parents always complain that there's high expectation from the side of men, and that any woman that you know, was married out without maybe some of the things that you know, accompany her to the matrimonial home, it's sometimes become an issue, to the extent that some cases of marital discords were actually found to have been caused by some of these things. Generally, Islam has encouraged simplicity in marriage, and moderation is also very important. So we look at the context, we also look at the society, and then we try to, as much as possible, make things easy by not insisting that things that are not necessary things that may constitute hardship in, you know, the marriage are actually, you know, upheld. Things that are not, one, necessary, two, they are not going to, in the most cases, support the sustainability of the marriage, should all be discouraged. And then while the men always call for, you know, simplicity, ease in marriage, we find that they also have high expectation. So I think we also need to understand that for men, we should not impose on them what they cannot afford. And then from the side of the woman, that's her parents, they shouldn't be expected to provide her with what is not their primary responsibility. Until we agree that simplicity is important, and this simplicity should come in form of moderation. Nobody is saying that people should not spend, but at least they should spend moderately. There shouldn't be any extravagance, and then there shouldn't be hardship and difficulties. People should not be made to face hardship or to go through hardship and difficulty simply because they want to marry. If we insist that they have to provide this, provide that, a whole list, you know, be presented to the, you know, to the proposed or the intended groom, that this is what you are going to provide and you must provide it, or else there will not be marriage. That will definitely make marriage very difficult. And then also, if from the side of the man, we expect the parents of the lady to provide X, Y, Z before she is brought to our home, I think that will also make life very difficult. So we have to accept the fact that moderation and simplicity are the key words as far as ease of marriage is concerned. And then it is also a kind of a two-way issue. It's not only from the side of the man or from the side of the woman, but we have to all agree that we need to be simple and we need to be moderate in the way we do things. This would be, you know, in accordance with our custom, because we cannot say there is a stress. I mean, there is maybe one cap fit all as far as marriage expenses or marital expenses is concerned. But at least we need to be moderate. Islam encourages moderation, and that we have to be moderate. Islam encourages simplicity, and we need to be simple in the way we do our marriages. Wallahu alam.
Thank you, Dit. Walaikum salam. This seems to be
technically.
Yeah.
I was actually the one that suggested that marriage should be made simpler, because that is the only legitimate way that somebody can express his sexual desires. I was the one that mentioned it as part of the preventive measures in sorting out the issue of rape. So, and I'm happy Alhaji Prof Dogarawa has already explained what is meant. You know, keeping a girlfriend, prolonging courtship, prolonging all these dating relationships and all that actually encourages people to try to satisfy these sexual desires outside marriage. So that is the main point I'm trying to make. If we make marriage as simple as possible, instead of having prolonged courtship, people having sexual desires they have to suppress over a very long time, how long can somebody sustain fasting? The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said that young men should fast. How long can they sustain fasting and all that? So if you can make it easy, as soon as it is feasible for somebody to get married, that the person gets married, I believe it will help to suppress them, and it will be a legitimate way to express sexual desire and also stop people from trying things that are haram. I don't know whether if there were other questions for me.
Unfortunately, we cannot take more questions. I think some of the questions have been responded to on your behalf. Probably Dr. Amina seems to, maybe she has something to say.
Oh, no, I'm fine.
Dr. Bashir, your last point.
Alhamdulillah, may Allah increase us in knowledge and practice.
Amen.
We are very grateful, first of all, to our panelists. We thank you very much for sparing your time, precious time, to be with us, to enlighten us and educate us on this very important topic. Of course, we can't conclude on everything. It's a very, very big topic, but I think we have additional knowledge. And we are in more clearer, have a clearer picture of the subject than before. We pray Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to increase you in knowledge, wisdom, and also put these in your Mizan al-Hasanat, scale of good deeds, in the Day of Judgment. I would like to thank the Dawah Institute of Nigeria of the Islamic Education Trust also for organizing this conference. I thank all the participants for following up with us from the beginning to the end. And let me apologize again for my inability to take your questions. It's just due to time constraint. Inshallah, hope we meet on topics like this next time. We hope to invite some of our speakers also more, I think, to learn and benefit more from them. Jazakumullahu khairan. On behalf of the Dawah Institute of Nigeria, I want to say Jazakumullahu khairan and thank you very much. May Allah reward you all abundantly. On the address, if you have any question or feel your question has not been addressed or answered, kindly send to the Dawah Institute of Nigeria. The email has been sent, as well as the phone number, dawahinstituteofnigeria@gmail.com, and the phone number 081-8102-2146, 081-8102-2146. Inshallah, we try to look at whatever question or recommendation you are making on these the presentations. As I said, for those who know the panelists, you may also wish to contact them. I know Dr. Amina is in Niger State here. I won't say more than that. Dr. Bashir Al-Furqan, let me be more specific on his own. He's known there. If you know how to meet him. Professor Dogarawa also in ABU Zaria, and also Professor Hajara Umar Sulaiman also in ABU Zaria. Once again, Jazakumullahu khairan. Subhanakallahu alhamdik. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله
وبركاته. وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته.